Blog Talk Radio.
24 hours ago, he was announced the winner of a $1 million contract from Steven Spielberg's DreamWorks Pictures. Tonight, he's here with the Movie Geeks for an exclusive interview. On the Lot champion Will Bingham is right here, folks. Plus, a remarkable film critic and journalist whose recent assignment had him sitting down with some of the most prominent film critics in the country. Aaron Ata-Diaz will join us to discuss the art of film criticism and so much more. It's all straight ahead on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to another fantastic Wednesday night episode of Movie Geeks United. I am one of your co-hosts, Jamie, and we have Jerry right here. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up? How's everyone doing?
Great show for you tonight. Just Jerry, by the way, do you know what I'm doing right now?
Yes, I do. You're doing it. You're actually multitasking big time right now.
I am holding the phone in one hand and a video camera in the other, because we're having a feature story done on us in one of the newspapers here locally. And the web is such a prominent force now with newspapers. They're actually adding video footage on the newspaper websites. And so I'm multitasking. I'm trying to film myself conducting the show. So I think I'm going to put this down right now and focus on my duties at hand. Just a couple of notes before we get started tonight. You can subscribe to our show via iTunes. It's completely free. If you look for the iTunes icon on the right-hand side of the page, just click on it. It'll take you right to our page on iTunes. Subscribe. Don't miss a minute of any of our shows. We got some wonderful shows. Just recently, we interviewed John Ottman, the famed composer and editor from the set of Valkyrie, the new Tom Cruise film in Berlin. And just on and on and on, the great guests that we've had lately on our show. It's just phenomenal. This Sunday, just as a reminder, we have a special two-hour tribute show to five outstanding character actors. Now, character actors, you know their faces, but they've been in everything under the sun, but you can't quite place the name, you know, and we want to correct that. We want to bring your attention to five incredible actors, two which have sadly deceased. But Jerry, can you tell the folks who the five actors are we're paying tribute to Sunday?
Well, I'm going to go Jack Warden, M. Emmett Walsh, Veronica Cartwright, J.T. Walsh, and help me out with the last one. Just help me out because it eludes me right now.
See, that's what I mean. That's exactly, if you saw his face, you know, Stephen Tobolowsky.
That's Stephen Tobolowsky. There you go.
That's
Groundhog
right.
Day, baby.
He's really in everything under the sun.
Oh, he is. Sneakers, yeah. Even like the smallest, the smallest roles, and he's like so memorable in all these movies, even like forgettable movies, but you remember him.
He's absolutely memorable. Yeah, and all of these actors are, and just phenomenal bodies of work. But that will be Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern, a special two-hour show. We've got great guests lined up for the show, co-stars and close friends of every single one of these fine actors. So we're very excited about that. So, Jerry, you all set to get started on tonight's show? This is a great show tonight.
Yeah, no, we have probably tonight one of the most interesting shows. We have the winner of last night's On the Lot.
That's right.
And I have to say about Will Bingham, I mean, of all the people, this is like a really storybook ending. I was just rewatching his video, his intro video, and reading about him again. And, you know, and also he was a favorite of a lot of our MySpace fans.
Yes.
People rooting for him. And it's just so great to see him win.
He's phenomenal.
It really is.
He's phenomenal. You ready for my official intro?
Yes.
Charlie Rose intro?
Yes, I am.
Okay. You've all heard the rap on the movie business. It's a cutthroat, take-no-prisoners world that mercilessly delivers a million rejections and compromises for every single triumph. As it turns out, there's another medium that can go toe-to-toe with the movie business any day in illustrating the agony of defeat and the pure thrill of victory. And I'm talking, of course, about competition-based reality television. Now, we seem to be inundated with this sort of programming, but finally, courtesy of Steven Spielberg and Uber producer Mark Burnett, the world got a show that was tailor-made for the inner movie geek in all of us. I'm speaking, of course, of On the Lot, a program that promised a $1 million contract with Steven Spielberg's DreamWorks Pictures to one filmmaker out of tens of thousands of hopefuls. Last night, after a period of several sweat-inducing months, America finally discovered the winner of this fierce competition, and his name is Will Bigham, a fantastically talented director whose unique, crowd-pleasing visions captivated millions across the country. We are honored to have this extraordinary filmmaker here with us tonight, one day after his remarkable victory. Mr. Bigham, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you great. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
How was your first full day in the new office?
It was great. You know, I walked in a little nervous, a little overwhelming walking into the DreamWorks offices, but everybody there is extremely nice, you know, just welcoming and down to earth, and, you know, I've found a great home. It's going to be nice.
Wow. It's just a great achievement for you. Take me back to the beginning. When did you first know that you wanted to be a filmmaker?
When I first, I was working as a stage actor for about 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And I had one night I had the actor's nightmare. I'm standing on stage and my mind goes blank. My mouth is still moving. I'm still saying all my lines, but I'm totally in my head thinking, what are you doing on this stage? And I knew that I had to change something because I had been working on stage pretty much 365 days a year for 5 years straight. And I was like, well, what do I want to do? And I decided, you know, why not? I love film. Let's go try to make some films. So I applied to film schools, got into Florida State University's films program, and that was about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and moved out here ever since. I've been working out here ever since.
Wow. Well, you have a wife and two daughters, correct?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
And both you and your wife have been working within the industry for a number of years.
Yes, we met in college, in undergrad, as theater majors,
uh-huh.
And as soon as we graduated, we both started working at that theater in Virginia, the Barter Theater, and we worked there for 5 years together.
Okay.
And as soon as I went to film school, that's when we started having kids. So.
Wow. So what were your motivations for taking part in the show, and what did you hope it would do for you?
You know, this business is so tough to get your foot in the door.
Mm.
And everybody's always looking for that way to just nudge their foot in there. And I saw this opportunity through an alumni letter from Florida State, and I saw it, you know, as an opportunity to just kick the door wide open.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it had Steven Spielberg attached to it. I said, why not? So I went for it, and it worked. So there you go.
Wow. Well, you had some pretty stiff competition. I mean, just an incredibly talented bunch of contestants on that show. What was your mindset like during this whole process? Do you have to just psych yourself to think, you know, I'm going to take this home, I'm going to win this, or were there moments of skepticism when you saw some of the other works that kind of had you doubtful a bit?
Well, when we first started, and it was that group of 50, I was extremely doubtful that I would even make the cut. You know, I didn't think I was even going to get on the show.
Right.
There were so many talented people in that room. And I thought that was it for me. But as soon as I made it onto the final 18, onto the show, and we showed our one-minute shorts, our comedy shorts, where it showed Lucky Penny,
right.
You know, after seeing everybody's film, I thought, you know, this might be doable. I might make it to the finals, I hope. And as time progressed and I saw everybody's work around me, you know, of course I got nervous, but the only thing I could do is just focus on the movie that I was making that week. And that was the only thing that kept me going.
Right.
It was such it had to have been such a grueling exercise to have to produce a different film every week. Tell me about how taxing that process was, the challenges of that.
It was a delight. It really was. I mean, the one thing that we had going for us is that we didn't have to deal with a lot of the production of it.
Mm.
We had a line producer who, believe me, has had the hardest job of anybody in Hollywood for 3 months there. He had to line up our locations and line up all of our, make sure that our, you know, our props and catering and everything was in the right place at the right time. So he took a lot of the stress out. The main stress that we had was the delivery of it. We had 8 hours a day to shoot for 2 days, and then we had 10 hours to edit. And the 10 hours of editing, that was where most of my fingernails went off. Just to make sure I got my movie cut in 10 hours was tough.
Wow, that's quite an exercise. You had exposure to so many talented people, both from the judging side of it to you know, the behind the scenes and the actors in front of the camera. What kind of jewels of wisdom did you take from these different people?
Well, just watching the other directors around me and the directors of photography, I just learned new things every single day. You know, how they were, where they were putting the camera, you know, what interesting angles they were going for, and how the other directors would talk to their actors, and how they would talk to the production designer. You know, you could just take little bits from all of that. But as far as the judges go, I mean, those guys, you know, at times we would just hear some piece of information that would just drive us on to the next thing, like hearing F. Gary Gray talking about, you know, just stay passionate about what you're doing. Don't change who you are. Just make sure that you're going with what you want to do. So, you know, it's always encouraging to hear things like that.
Yeah, yeah. I understand the first movie you ever saw was E.T.?
Yes, it was.
So how thrilling must it have been for you to be greeted by Spielberg? And he spoke to you last night like a major fan of your work, like just another fellow filmmaker and a true fan. What was that experience like?
I don't remember. he's such a nice guy, so down to earth. And I mean, it's kind of surreal to be standing there in front of the guy who made your first favorite movie, your second favorite movie, and for him to say, you know, I appreciate this, you know, your comic timing and all this kind of stuff. It's like, you shouldn't be talking. You should just be like, you know, kissing your feet. But he was a great guy, and you know, I look forward to working with him.
Yeah, I saw they had a 90-minute documentary. I think it was Richard Schickel.
Richard Schickel, I think, yeah.
Yeah, produced one on Spielberg's resume and interviewed Spielberg about each of his films, and after 10 minutes I was exhausted. This man has made one classic film after another.
Yeah, he's one of, like, the most successful directors of all time.
He has to be, absolutely. I have to ask you about just in terms of the taping of the show. Now, what we saw last night when you walked up after you were announced the winner and you walked up and met Spielberg, was that actually live?
No, it was pre-taped just so that we could get our timing down.
Right.
Mr. Spielberg has a tight schedule, and he had just walked off of filming of Indiana Jones 4. So
yeah,
we had a very tight schedule to meet with his. So we did have to pre-tape that, but man, I tell you what, it was amazing. We didn't pre-tape it before we heard the results.
Right.
So, you know, after we heard the results, we went down to DreamWorks and waited for a little bit until he was available, and then we went with it. So.
So what kind of reaction have you received so far from your family or from people within the industry since your win?
It's been mind-boggling. I mean, I've never had so many emails in my entire life. Phone calls. Man, my cell phone bill is going to be outrageous this month, I guarantee that.
Oh. The prize was $1 million, and that goes towards the budget of your first film with DreamWorks?
Now, the way it works out is half of it goes towards salary for 2 years.
Okay.
And then the other half goes towards development.
Okay.
So I can hire writers, or I can option books or articles for 2 years. And then there's an option to extend it for a third year as well.
So have you had a preliminary meeting to kind of go over what the process is and what you hope to accomplish?
That's going to be tomorrow. I'm meeting tomorrow with Steven Spielberg and Stacy Snyder and Adam Goodman, all the execs of DreamWorks. So
wow.
Needless to say, I'm kind of nervous about that.
Oh, you'll be great. You'll be great.
You will be incredible. I mean, you're just an incredible filmmaker, a genuine talent, and yeah, I think DreamWorks is very fortunate to have you, actually. But what do you hope will come out of this? What are you hoping for, a particular piece of material or a particular genre?
You know, I love working with comedies, especially ones that are slightly darker. I won't say a dark comedy, but something that, you know, definitely has a darker twist to it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be looking for, you know, a Coen-esque type project.
Okay, cool.
I'm loving that. I'm loving that, definitely. Well, Mr. Bigham, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and best of luck.
And good luck to you. Thank you so much.
And please come back to us and let us know how things are developing for you, and we have all the confidence in the world in you. You're going to do awesome.
You're going to be great.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That is Will Bigham. He was last night's winner of a $1 million contract with DreamWorks Pictures, a phenomenal achievement and a great filmmaker. So expect a lot of incredible things out of him. It's going to be a wonderful journey for him, I'm sure. Meeting tomorrow with Spielberg.
I know. I mean, that's, you know, it just goes up from there. I mean,
wow. And just a great idea for a show. I feel sorry that it didn't. The show itself didn't really do more gangbuster ratings.
No, it doesn't seem like these type of shows do. I mean, like Project Greenlight, you know, diminished every season, and this does. I don't think they're. I unfortunately think what we, of course, us and our listeners, are very into this type of show and this type of genre. It never really caught on with the rest of the country.
Yeah, yeah, and I was rabid about Project Greenlight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
I think everyone was.
I could
was.
Not get enough of Project Greenlight. And this competition here, I mean, it's a great idea, and so many shows that aren't movie-related but similar in nature have reached to the top of the ratings as well. I hope they give it a second season because, you know, there's so many talented people out there. And
and it's just a good avenue. It's a good way for someone to break in. So,
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, and I think this is a show that needs to be nurtured. And it'll catch on big time, and I'm sure it's very popular among millions and millions of people, but the television rating system, I'm not quite sure how that even works.
I never got one. My family never got one of those boxes or whatever, so I don't get it.
And it really makes me question: is this really indicative of what people are really watching when you see the ratings?
Yeah, I know, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, so just a great conversation. I'm so glad to have him on tonight, and thank him so much for coming on. As soon as I heard his name announced, I sent out an interview request, and as you heard, he's been inundated with emails. So I'm very thankful that he found mine.
No, I just hope that for the rest of, you know, our years and everything that I, you know, we see, like, you know, created by or directed by Will Bigham.
We will.
I hope so. That would be very nice. I'd be very happy with that.
Especially with a guy, like Spielberg in this corner.
Yeah.
I wish I could be a fly on the wall in the meeting with Spielberg.
Kind of nervous about it. And I have nothing to do with it. I'm kind of nervous.
He made me nervous the second he said that, you know, because I put myself in his shoes. The second he said he was meeting with Spielberg and Stacy Schneider.
Yeah, I mean.
Wow. What a dream come true. All right, you ready for our next guest tonight?
Oh, I'm very ready for our next guest.
Our next guest is a phenomenal journalist and film critic whose writings you can find on rockcritics.com and Matt Zoller Seitz's highly popular blog, The House Next Door. Recently, he sat down with a handful of the most prominent film critics in the country, and he's here to tell us all about it tonight. It is an honor to welcome to our show Mr. Aaron Ata-Diaz. Aaron, are you there?
I am here.
Hey, Aaron, how you doing?
I am terrific.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited. Let me start off the bat by saying this is my first interview ever, print, let alone radio. So, like the man says, be gentle but firm.
I'll try to be both. It's the first time, you know, you're getting a taste of your own medicine. You're used to doing the interviewing.
I look forward to it. Before we start, I just want to say that I'm sorry that our other host cannot be here.
Yeah.
I understand he is cracking the books.
He is.
So when he listens to this, I just want to say, if your compadres do not ask questions that you had, talk to them and feel free to email or contact me, and I'll be more than willing to answer any questions because I just love talking about criticism and film and movies. And so I hope we can talk again where all three of us are together.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. Don't worry about that.
Okay. Absolutely. Chris is in the middle of a medical program at school, and that's very challenging, so we might have, we might not have him for many.
I'll recommend Gross Anatomy for him.
That's all the training he needs.
Yeah,
right?
there you go.
You know, we've you and I have talked on the phone for several hours over the past week, and I mean, you really know your stuff about movies. Tell me about your writing for RockCritics.com. What you do for them, and how this assignment of interviewing the film critics came about.
Well, what happened was I got a computer. I always had a computer, but I didn't really have internet access until March, April of 2003. I got a new computer, and up until then, the computer for me was kind of a glorified typewriter. Wrote my papers and whatever I wanted to write and printed it out. I was never really interested in being on the internet because I knew that I had the personality where if I had internet access, that I would probably be on there for several hours.
Smart man.
Yeah.
Smart man.
Yeah, so I knew that, but my dad's like, look, you need to get going. You know, and my dad is not a computer person by any stretch, but he had a computer and he did surf. And he's like, look, instead of me surfing for you and reading to you, look, I'm just going to give you a new computer. I'm going to get you one, and you're going to get access, and that's all there is to it. And so that's what happened in 2003. And of course, that summer of 2003, I barely left my room, just surfing the web. I mean, it just opened up everything.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, time went on, and it was, I guess, April of 2004. And I love film criticism. I was huge. I have my favorite critics, and I just study film criticism and film and all that. So I was like, well, I wonder if there are interviews with critics online, because I just like critics in general, whether it's music critics or book critics or anything.
Yeah.
And so by Google and all that stuff, I came across rockcritics.com. And it was just, to me, it was an amazing site because they had all these in-depth interviews with all these established rock critics, you know, Chuck Eddy, Robert Christgau, Grill Marcus, Ken Tucker.
Wow.
You know, all these guys, and they were in-depth interviews, and they really got into the meat and potatoes of rock criticism, and I just thought it was great. And it was a very simple site, but these interviews were just awesome. You know, Tom Carson and all these other guys. And so, the editor, Scott Woods, great guy, great man, he had his email on the site. And so the semester was coming to an end. It was May, and I remember, like, the day, like, semester ended, like, on a Thursday. So I spent Friday, Saturday, Sunday kind of resting, decompressing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Monday I sent off an email saying, love your site, love these interviews, been printing them and reading them, just think they're terrific. How would you feel about doing similar type of interviews but with movie critics?
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I did not know how the internet really worked, and then I didn't know if I was going to get an immediate response or if I was not going to get a response or whatever. But I got a response like that. And he says, love the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Great idea. And I think in the first email he says, who do you want to do? And that's how quickly it turned into something. And so it was just one of those things. And because when I did do surfing the web for interviews with other critics, of course, Pauline Kael came up.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of those. And
Roger, she wasn't available for
these. She wasn't available.
No, I would say that would be pretty impossible.
Yeah, but
well,
that's what I want to ask you. How did you come about with these names?
Well, I just liked reading film criticism wherever I could get it, and it was just one of those deals. I just picked up the critics I liked through the years. In 1994, for my mom, just because, and this was my freshman year in high school. And my mom knew how much I liked criticism and film and pop culture. She got me a subscription to Entertainment Weekly. She just thought the magazine, I would like it. And I did, and I just thought it was a great magazine. And it's wonderfully put together. And I just got hooked on their two critics who
right.
had been there from the beginning almost. And I really, and I'm a huge Ebert fan. As a kid in the 80s, obviously, I was a product of Siskel and Ebert, and from there, you know, and that's probably the story of a couple of generations of people growing up in the 80s who were not in L.A. or New York or Chicago.
Absolutely.
You know, Siskel and Ebert was that show where yeah, you saw them review the big films that you wanted to see, like a Batman, but then also, you know, that fourth or fifth review in the show was that little obscure film.
That's right, a Jarmusch film or something.
Yeah, you know, and you, and as a kid, you may be like, well, you know, it's not really appealing, but if you got enough of those reviews from them,
mm-hmm.
and on the rare occasion of one of those films clicking and it came to your city or town, it was like, well, Siskel and Ebert liked it, or Siskel liked it, or Ebert liked it, so I want to go try to, and so, you know, natural progression. And then, you know, the Ebert books every year would collect his reviews, and,
mm-hmm.
and if you read the introductions, Ebert would say, read these critics. And so, you know, it's just all those things. And so that happened, and, but, like, I got the Entertainment Weekly subscription, and so I just gravitated to Owen Gleiberman's criticism in particular. I do believe he is one of our finest critics working today.
Right.
For the limited space that the magazine gives him, he can turn a phrase and really express an idea of a film or performance like no one else.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I just knew that I was in sync with him on a lot of things. I knew I was probably not in sync on some other things, and he's branched out after my interview. At one point, he branched out after the interview. He started writing some more kind of think pieces. He now writes commentaries on EW.com that are
mm-hmm.
just as vital.
Right, they are.
And he's terrific. And when I got that email back, they said, who do you want to do first? And my first thing, I want to interview Owen Gleiberman.
Right.
And I must say this. I wanted to do these interviews, but my immediate goal was, okay, this is an avenue where I can meet Owen Gleiberman, of all things. You know, you hear stories about celebrities like Madonna or Courtney Love or any, you know, these celebrities, you know, they had these goals when they were kids, you know, they
right.
wrote in their diaries like, you know, I want to be friends with this person, I want to accomplish this, I want to accomplish that. Well, I never did any of that, but one of my goals, like, when I was I want to interview Owen Gleiberman. I want to have a chat with him about
mm-hmm.
film, because I knew we would probably click, and so that was kind of the immediate, the immediate spark of these interviews. Like, okay, well, this is my one chance for me to interview Owen Gleiberman, talk to him through this, and it happened, and it wasn't just going to happen overnight. It just so happened that one of the critics, rock critics, that they had an interview with was Ken Tucker, who was at that time the TV critic
for
Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah.
So I got through Ken Tucker, I got Owen's email, and he said yes, and it just that whole summer was just crazy. That summer of 2004 was crazy because it was just going back and forth with Owen on these interviews.
So you got Owen Gleiberman, you got Lisa Schwartzbaum, another
right.
film critic at EW. Two very distinctive voices, by the way.
Oh, very.
James
very
Bernard, the
too.
New York Daily News.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Clark, USA Today. Janet Maslin, New York Times.
Ooh.
Glenn Kenny, Premier. David Edelstein of Slate
and
New York Magazine. Phenomenal roster.
Yeah, I gotta ask, what was it like interviewing Janet Maslin? Because now she's the book critic for the New York Times.
Janet Maslin is a terrific person. She, because it's the New York Times, all their writers, critics, and all of them, they're very on guard on, this is just my impressions, but they all seem to be very on guard when they get requests for interviews or anything, because whenever you're interviewing anyone from the New York Times, you're not just interviewing that person. That person is a representative of the New York Times.
Right, right.
So they have to be careful what they say and make sure that they say, you know, distinguish their opinion and that they're not representing the New York Times when they say this and
right.
vice versa.
Yeah, because she was always like, when growing up, she was always like, I guess, the cool mother to Vincent Canby's mean, I hate everything kind of, but she was always like the cool one, like the cool older sister you always wanted. And I guess Manola Dargis has definitely filled in her shoes, created her own persona. But
yeah.
Janet Maslin was always the one who was a little bit more lenient on some of the popcorn flicks where Vincent Canby would just tear them apart.
Yeah. Well, I asked her in the interview, I go, you know, you were of age in the 80s, you, at the time, you were reviewing the all these blockbusters. And she did pretty good in putting them in perspective. You know, they were well made, you know. And, of course, a lot of them were Spielberg, so they were going to be well made. And so you couldn't yet, it was kind of a paradox, I guess, for film critics in the 80s that, yes, we were, the culture was being divided in the into blockbusters and everything else.
Right.
And but if you're truly honest with yourself, you couldn't deny the fact that a lot of these blockbusters were great entertainments.
Absolutely.
So that is a paradox. I think Kale, initially, she was, you know, she liked E.T., she liked Temple of Doom, she liked Empire Strikes Back, but I think as the decade went on, she kind of...
I think she got tired.
She got tired and wary of those, of the blockbusters, to the point that... even in the interviews in the 90s after she retired and they would talk about that era, she wouldn't bring up that the fact that she liked Empire Strikes Back and the fact that she liked Temple of Doom. And that was, I always find it a little sad that, you know, she wouldn't, she couldn't see that, you know, we're in this culture, but some of these were great films. I mean, her review of Temple of Doom is just remarkable. It really
Yes, it is.
It really captures.
It's absolutely glowing. And she really had her eye on Spielberg from the very beginning. And I think she was the first major critic that voiced the fact that I think she actually said something to the effect of that Spielberg's framing was far and above anyone else's. That this man has an eye and look out for him. Let's talk about Kale for a little bit because I know you bring up Kale to most, if not all, of the critics that you interviewed, because she is such a she's the beacon, you know, for film criticism when it started to be considered an art form unto itself. I personally am in love with Pauline Kael's writing. Even if I agree with her, don't agree with her, it's
you can't argue. She knew so much. She brought so much to the art. She made it an art form because she not only brought film, but she brought everything. Into it.
And she loved she did not dismiss the pop culture you know, kind of junk food aspect of certain
movies. That's actually very important that you bring that up, Jamie, and reiterate that, because a lot of people don't know that. A lot of people dismiss her as stuffy, pretentious.
She was not stuffy.
She's anything but that.
Yeah, she was so passionate and acerbic. First of all, she was a dynamite writer. And she was very funny as well, very insightful. What is the general consensus among the critics you interviewed concerning Pauline Kael?
Well, when I bring up the Kael question, it's very specific. On some people, it's very general. On some people, it's very specific. Because through all my research, I do know, for the most part, which critics kind of knew Pauline or met her or so forth. So I kind of dispense with the... What did you think of the Kale? What impact did the Kale / Andrew Serra schools of film criticism have on you? That's the general question, and they'll answer it. But on a couple occasions, obviously, I knew before the interview that there were a couple of people who were friends with Pauline or knew of Pauline, and so I just dispensed with that. I was like, okay, tell me a Pauline story. And so, so that's kind of how that worked. And I must note that not all the people I interviewed are out and out Pauline supporters. They acknowledge they all acknowledge her importance and her jazziness as a writer. But Glenn Kinney and Mike Clark, in particular, they are Serra-sites. They're Andrew Serra's, and they feel he's the one that got to them first, and so there is that. Vision, and Serra is a good writer and a terrific critic and also a great film historian also, as his wife is, the wonderful Molly Haskell.
That's right.
You know, there were also stories that they told about personal interaction with Kale.
Right.
And how kind of, how they kind of had to navigate their way into her good graces based upon what their own views of films were, because she could be incredibly dismissive. It wasn't that the case?
That was the case with some. There is a whole, you know, there is what they call the Paulettes, or the Sons of Pauline people who were in her circle, and they were they are labeled as people who carry on her kind of, I guess you could say, manifesto.
Elvis Mitchell and Armand White.
Yeah.
Elvis, Armand. Although Armand, who I would love to interview when I have more of, I guess, stamina, because Armand's a very, he's a very, in his writing at least, he's very confrontational and very absolute in his stance.
That's putting it mildly.
And, you know, he gets the same, we interviewed Armand White for the De Palma show.
Right.
He gets the same kind of rap that Pauline Kael got in the idea that he wants to have an opinion counter to everyone else's,
mm-hmm.
where it might not be a genuine opinion.
He's very, I will say this, in what I've done in my reading of him, he's very selective in that he doesn't drop Kael's name that often. When he does, it is in support of what he says. But when he does separate from her on an opinion, and he'll talk about the critics who were wrong at the time, and at least in my mind, he kind of purposely omits calling her out. A classic example, and you can find it online, is his 2003 reassessment of Scarface, when it had that 20th anniversary re-release, and he talks about the critics who dismissed Scarface and so forth, but he doesn't name Kael in particular.
Yes.
And so I always found that kind of amusing.
Yeah.
And Kael, even being the champion of De Palma that she was, pretty much decimated Scarface.
Yeah, I mean, no one championed Scarface. I mean, what a lot of people don't realize, and God, you got to forgive me for bringing this up again, Jamie. But no, please forgive me. But it was not. It was a critical and commercial failure when it
yes.
opened. It's like the first.
Well,
it's the first champion of the home video success of home video.
I think it actually turned out to be the second or the third top grossing movie that year, behind Jedi or something.
Yeah, I will differ.
Oh, I thought it was The Hunger, but okay, you guys know better than me.
No, I will say it did get a critical drubbing.
Yeah.
The two critics that I am aware of who praised it, ironically enough, were Vincent Canby and Roger Ebert.
No, Ebert did champion it, and he championed De Palma's crusade against the ratings
right.
board.
And so, but this is something that does get kind of lost in the translation, that Scarface did make money, but
yes.
like a lot of films that made money, it didn't make the money they were expecting it.
That they
yeah,
thought.
It did make blockbuster money.
It didn't make.
You know what I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those movies that it's hard to review at the time of release, because it is such a movie of its time.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, given our reflection of the '80s, we can recognize Scarface as the quintessential '80s movie.
Well, that's
a good point.
The two things, you are right that, I mean, even if it did make money theatrically, it obviously made tenfold more in home video. That is
true,
and also with the embracing of it in the hip-hop culture and so forth.
Oh, it took on a whole new life in hip-hop culture.
Yes, and also it is interesting to know. It is funny, if you go back to your history, what was considered a suitable film for, you know, Oscar / Christmas season, and the fact that
in terms
Scarface,
of endearment,
yeah, the fact that Scarface was a Christmas release,
yes,
and I'm assuming their Oscar, because they obviously thought they had The Godfather.
Oh yeah,
thought. And you look at Scarface even now, and you're like, you got to laugh, because you're like, you thought this being released at Christmas was going to get you some nominations?
Yeah, I mean, you had Terms of Endearment and The Right Stuff, if I'm not mistaken, were the best picture contenders that
right.
year.
Big Chill was another one.
Yeah, like
I said, I mentioned the junk food earlier. It's
yeah.
the junk food version of The Godfather. It's, you know, it's
dude, that's
pure
the most brilliant thing I've heard in a long time, Jamie. That's a good analogy.
Thank you. Okay, we can end the show now.
No, we can't end the show. We're not doing what we did last week. No way.
So, getting back to the Pauline stuff, so having the traffic that, you know, I asked questions so they could, I asked the Pauline questions in a way that they could make their case for Pauline or or Saris, or make their case of being lumped in with the Paulettes and not approving of that. Because I took the tack in that there's no point in being confrontational, especially with these interviews, because I don't want that.
Right.
My goal, when every critic that I've interviewed, I have chosen because I, A, want to, I'm a fan, and B, I want to know them. I want to get to know them on a personal level. So I'm not going to interview any critic that I'm not a fan of or that I'm not wanting to know. So I can disagree with a critic, you know, 9 times out of 10, like an Armand White, but I still, at some point, I do want to interview him because he is someone that does intrigue me. And so that's kind of my mandate when I choose a critic that I want to interview. So I
definitely want, I had you pick 3 films this evening that we can discuss. But before we get to that, there's one more. We might go a little bit over tonight for the benefit of our archive listeners. The archive listeners can listen to the show in its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to talk a little bit about one more thing with your interviews. It's kind of a litmus test. Around the time you conducted these interviews, The Passion of the Christ had been released, and there was a firestorm of controversy and also major business that the film did. It was on everyone's lips that time of that year. You talked about the kind of, most people did not give it favorable reviews, most critics.
Nope.
And you talked about the backlash for that. Could you speak to that a little bit?
I think Jamie Bernard would be the first one to...
Because
I interviewed Owen and Jamie almost on top of each other, really back-to-back. And those interviews got online within, like, about 2 weeks of each other.
Mm.
And so this was, like, late August, early September of 2004. And so The Passion is still fresh in people. It's probably still playing at that point in theaters. You know,
it is. And it also just came out on DVD that August, I think.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's still around... So, and I just knew, because of all the critics I read, that I knew a lot of them got mail. You know,
vicious hate mail.
Vicious hate mail. The thing I think I told you, Jamie, is that, you know, ironically, Entertainment Weekly did a He Said, She Said review.
Yeah.
Owen did a review, and Lisa did a review in the same issue.
And Lisa got vicious hate mail.
Yeah, well, they both got hate mail, and the weirdly amusing part, you know, Owen gave it a B. You know, he gave it a mixed to positive review, and he said it was, and he's very eloquent in his interview saying that it is a genuine phenomenon. The violence is a crucial part of that film's success, and he thought it was justified, but it was limiting also, but he gave it a B because it was a well-made film. And even with a B, you know, which is good, you know, passing, thumbs up, whatever, he got hate mail.
Oh, yeah, he did.
So it kind of showed you that, you know, anything less than 4 stars, an A, a 10, for a lot of people on that film was unacceptable. And so...
But it does raise an interesting question about film criticism.
Mm-hmm.
How you can separate your personal prejudices, your personal beliefs, morals... Mm-hmm. from reviewing the film objectively, or if that is even a consideration for a film critic?
You can't, and what the job of the film reviewer and, you know, within the writing of the review is working that out, and how is the film challenging you, and is it noteworthy because it's challenging you in a good way, or if it's doing it in a cheap way.
Yeah.
So that, I think, is... That is what film criticism does. Film criticism is a discussion. So all this talk about, you know, critics don't matter to me because, you know, they don't make or break a film, to me that's kind of a non-issue. Critics do matter because long after the film is on DVD and on playing at 2:30 in the morning on TBS or whatever, you know, those reviews will reflect the moment that film came out and what people were thinking of that film that week. And if the film catches on and is a phenomenon, I can almost guarantee you that that film will be brought up in other reviews or in other commentaries, and it will become part of the discussion, and that's what critics do. The reason why, you know, people ask, you know, how come, you know, critics matter as much as they did back in the day and they don't matter now? It's, I thought about this, and I actually had a moment where it kind of came all together for me the other day. IFC has been running these kind of documentaries on indie sexuality.
Yeah.
And they did one on indie sex censored.
Right.
And someone pointed, and so they were doing like a timeline, and so, you know, we had that Hays Code, production code.
Right.
All that stuff. But in the late 60s, when we actually got a rating system, that really opened up the floodgates on what you could show in film. Because the moment they did away with the Hays Code, and we got a rating system, and whether it's arbitrary or you don't believe in a rating system, that's beside the point. The fact is, that rating system initially gave a sense of freedom to filmmakers that they had not had up to that point. And so you think about the moment we got a rating system, that's when we got Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice,
yeah.
Alice's Restaurant, Midnight Cowboy, Clockwork Orange, you know, Carnal Knowledge, Last Tango. It was just a floodgate, you know, nudity and sex and profanity and violence. And so that was a major shift in our culture, and that coincided with the major shift of what was going on in the country at the time, whether it was political and also the war and all and social and racial and all that. So it was inevitable that criticism was going to be commenting on all that stuff, because all that stuff was going to be starting to be reflected in the movies. And so that's why critics, just as long as any commentator, became an it thing to read, because
yeah.
they were talking about what was going on in America that week. But times have cooled. We're actually getting a little repressive, and we've had little shifts, little ratings things, you know, but the PG-13 and the NC-17, those are not as seismic in events as that first rating system. So critics still matter, but the reason why it's not like it was back then is because we've now kind of plateaued,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
which is ironic because, if anything, we're probably in a more politicized era than ever before.
Right.
True.
And so I do think the internet is where we're getting a lot of the next generation of critics.
Mm-hmm.
There's some great stuff going on the internet, and a lot of these critics, like Owen and Glenn and Jamie, who started off in print, they are now embracing the internet. Glenn Kenny of Premiere, he now has a blog. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Jamie has a blog. Owen is writing stuff for the EW.com, and so. So I think there's a lot of good stuff going on, and there's a lot of exciting critics.
Yeah, the internet is becoming.
I agree with you 100% there.
Let's talk about. We're running out of time, so
okay.
I want to get to your. I guess we can call them flick picks or movies
okay.
that we can discuss tonight. I asked you to pick three.
Okay.
Difficult challenge for us, definitely. I can imagine.
Every day for me.
So let's talk about some of these movies tonight. Give me your first pick.
My first pick, I had talked to you about this, and it is a 1986 film,
mm-hmm.
and I consider it the best Elmore Leonard adaptation, and that is John Frankenheimer's 52 Pickup.
I like this guy. yeah, my brother took me to see this film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How old were you when he took you to see it?
Wait, are you trying to say that I failed out of high school? No, I was, I think I was 15.
Wow.
Great film for a 15-year-old to see.
Hey, you're telling me. I have
tells you everything you need to know about life, right?
Yeah, right there.
Well,
Chief Brody's the star. Come on.
Yeah, all I'll say is vanity as a stripper.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
that's,
yeah.
That's all you need to know. Before she got religious.
Aren't you talking about Action Jackson?
No. but what I do stand by what I said. Obviously the Holy Trinity of Elmore Leonard adaptations is Get Shorty, Jackie Brown, and Out of Sight. And I love those films. I'm fans of those films. They're great adaptations. But to me, 52 Pickup by Frankenheimer, gets the sweaty, punchy, claustrophobic feeling that you get when you do read an Elmore Leonard novel.
Mm.
It's properly sleazy and depraved and just an exciting thriller, and has great performances across the board by actors who are great actors but are rarely given a chance to shine. Not only, obviously, Roy Scheider, who is a great actor, but Clarence Williams III,
mm-hmm.
and Margaret gives a great performance. Vanity, Robert Trevor as the Leo, a real sweaty guy, real
yeah.
Weasley guy. And for my money, the third best villain of 1986, John Glover's Alan Raimi, is one of the great villains of the 80s.
That's
and
true.
And he is so good that if it was any other year, he'd probably be the villain of the year. And the only reason he ranks third in 1986 is because he is topped by Tom Noonan's Francis Dolarhyde, a.k.a. the Tooth Fairy from Manhunter,
mm-hmm.
and Dennis Hopper's Frank Booth from Blue Velvet.
Yeah, that's a terrific trio right
yeah.
there.
So,
those are people you don't yeah. want to spend any time
yeah.
with in real
any
life.
Any other year, John Glover would have been the villain of the year. But
yeah.
1986, he had to take Bronze, but he is in terrific company.
That is a terrific film.
And
very great. Is that available on DVD
yet? It just came out in May.
Okay.
May, June, this past summer on DVD. It's a bare-bones edition, but doesn't matter just as long as now we finally have it.
Yeah.
And as much print Frankenheimer got in the late 90s for Ronin, which is an okay film in my opinion, to me Frankenheimer's 52 Pickup is the real unsung jewel in his.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Give us your second one.
The second one is one, I just saw it again on TV because I was flipping and it hooked me, and it's an underrated film, and my dad was a labor person. He was a union guy for air traffic controllers, and so I was raised in a union family.
Uh-huh.
And it's the underrated and misunderstood Hoffa by Danny DeVito.
Oh, very oh. underrated.
Which, at the time, I think it was taken for granted that Nicholson was going to get a double nomination for Hoffa in lead and A Few Good Men in supporting. But
yeah.
Hoffa got snubbed, and seeing it again, and it's a 15-year-old movie now, I do think it is one of his great performances. And Hoffa is just a great film. It is not a straight biography,
mm-hmm.
and it's more of a requiem for the labor movement.
That's why I think it works, actually, because it's
yeah.
not a straight biopic.
And it is terrific. The image that when I saw it again that really haunted me is late in the film when Danny DeVito, who has been let out of jail, but Jimmy Hoffa is still in jail, and he's dressed in his black outfit, and he walks onto a golf course where
he says, "You got to get him out." Yeah,
he says,
yeah.
"Got to get him out." And to me, the scene really works because he almost looks like a ghost, and the scene is very sad in that you can see how the labor movement has kind of died in America and has
mm-hmm.
now moved on
yeah.
to the golf course where, you know, deals are made and it's moved away from the picket line.
Absolutely.
And that is a great image. And, so
and that's,
great
a great, that's a great scene with J.T. Walsh, who we're paying tribute to.
Yeah.
One of the great villains. And Kevin Anderson does the best rendering of Robert Kennedy
yes.
in any film or television.
Oh, I love when Jack Nicholson's Hoffa goes up and against him and everything in that one scene where he lets him have it.
And, you know, the movie has, speaking about, I want to say two things about this movie. There's the theatricality to the way it is shot and designed.
It's a beautiful
yeah.
widescreen film.
I remember seeing a featurette on how he shot it. You know, there's
mm-hmm.
a scene in the where his wife is visiting him and gives him the details of a plea bargain that will get him out
right.
of jail. And it's shot from underneath both of them.
Mm-hmm.
He nods in agreement. They separate. The camera pans through them into another room where you see a welcoming rally for Hoffa from his union workers.
Yeah, there's a lot of just, you know, kind of audacious transitions in that film that are, yes, they are showy, but they also work, and
yeah.
they're just kind of fun to kind of, you know, in a film class, you kind of want to pick them apart. I do want to make mention, there's a lot of great performances in there, obviously Nicholson and J.T. Walsh and DeVito and Robert Prosky.
Yeah, Robert Prosky's good in that, too.
Mondesante.
And a little known, unknown at the time, he'd only done a couple of films, a very young John C. Reilly.
Yeah.
A pivotal role.
Isn't Frank Whaley in that too?
Yes, he plays the one that did the hit at the end.
Yeah.
Who I just saw last week. I watched that movie Vacancy.
He's very good. If ever a villain, a sleazy hotel clerk role was written for Frank Whaley, it was that film.
He was tailor-made for that.
I actually really enjoyed Vacancy.
Oh, yeah.
It still has those moments where you think, oh, God, come on. But like every horror movie. But I think it really worked. The concept alone was frightening. The other thing I want to say about Hoffa is, back to Nicholson, anyone that cannot get over the Jack aspect of Nicholson, you know, they have a problem believing that he can disappear in a character. Hoffa is one of those roles where he truly does disappear.
He does disappear, and like I said, I've seen it recently. I realized it is probably one of Nicholson's best performances in his later years, and probably one of those performances that it's when the obits are written on Nicholson, it's going to get overlooked, or it's only going to get a glancing tip of the hat, and I think it is good. I mean, and I love about Schmidt, and I love The Departed, but Hoffa is really something special. Real quick on Vacancy, I do want to make this point. Having sat through 1408, which I didn't like, if you watch that film, 1408, it makes you appreciate the efficiency of Vacancy a whole lot more.
It is a tight little movie. It really is, and I was pleased that it wasn't grotesque.
No.
You know, you saw just enough to know that this is beyond terrifying.
It
seemed like a real throwback. Even from the opening credits, they were Psycho-esque.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Grindhouse fan, but it was a real throwback to a Grindhouse-type movie, and it was a rare fully awake performance by Luke Wilson.
Yeah. Okay, give us your third pick. We're running out of time.
Okay, my third pick, and this is kind of a tribute to my main man, Owen Gleiberman, who, if you read his interview, one of his all-time favorite films is Psycho, and I agree. It's a great, great Hitchcock film.
Mm-hmm.
But they've been showing this on Cinemax for the past couple of months, and I watched it again. Hadn't seen it since I was a kid, and it is a good little thriller that probably got a lot of this drubbing that a lot of quote-unquote sequels are getting and remakes are getting. But Psycho 2 is a good little film, and if you're willing to accept it on its own term, it has some good scares, and it is really energized by a wonderful Anthony Perkins performance.
Yeah.
He really, you know, it's 22 years later after the first Psycho, and he really recaptures the Norman Bates mood and nuances, and he doesn't play it for laughs, and it really is a continuation of that performance.
That's was it Richard Lester? Who directed that one?
Richard Franklin.
Franklin.
Who just died recently.
Yeah.
He did a couple of films in the early 80s that got cult status. One is, Road Games with Jamie Lee Curtis?
With Stacy Keach. That's a very good film.
And one personal to me, it's a good little thriller also, and it was filmed here in San Antonio, Texas, Cloak and Dagger.
Oh, yeah, with Henry Thomas.
That was a favorite of mine when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Hey, Dabney Coleman was the shit.
Yes, he was back in the day.
I don't know if that phrase has ever been spoken.
I don't think Dabney Coleman and any of the shit have ever been used together.
But it was Jack Flack. Everyone wanted to be Jack Flack, man. It was cool.
Yeah.
Psycho 2, if you talk about Anthony Perkins, that was a role that changed the course of his life and probably limited his future possibilities because he was just so vivid. You know, you think of the possibilities of how that role could be played, and you can imagine, you know, the straightforward kind of typical. But he infused it with such eccentricities and sly humor.
It is funny to compare his portrayal to Vince Vaughn in that, you know, I looked this up. You know, Anthony Perkins was also very tall. He was like 6'2", 6'3", just like Vince Vaughn is very tall. But for some reason, so they were similar in height and all that stuff, but for some reason, Perkins was very, you know, fragile, and he looked small.
Uh-huh.
And so that was kind of the deception that worked for the Norman Bates character, where if you look at Vince Vaughn's performance, he may have been Anthony Perkins' height, but he had such a bulk, you know, football player kind of bulkiness, that whenever he tried to do those scenes where he's trying to be all timid and stuttering, it just doesn't work. In Perkins, you were kind of startled that he was going nuts, where Vince Vaughn, he's kind of off his rocker from the first scene.
Perkins is a lot more fragile.
Owen, going back to my man Owen, he actually, I remember in his review of the remake of Psycho, which he gave a B, he said it is an interesting stunt, but he was very smart when he said that, very astute when he said that the role should have gone to Jeremy Davies from Saving Private Ryan, because Saving Private Ryan had just come out, and you can almost see Davies would have been the most apt person to reprise Norman Bates.
Or from Spanking the Monkey, too.
Well, he did, and also remember, he did, the Helter Skelter film on CBS.
Yes.
Yeah, he actually listened to tapes of Manson.
He's got that thing down, the shakiness, and
he's remarkable in that movie. It's not a remarkable movie, but he is remarkable in it.
Yeah.
Aaron.
Okay.
I thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah,
thank you. You have an open invitation. Come back to us anytime.
I look forward to it. I had a lot of fun.
Likewise.
Keep up the good work. It's a terrific show.
Thank you.
And keep up the good work. Good luck on Sunday show.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Bye-bye, Aaron.
Bye-bye.
Great guest and just a terrific movie lover. And that's why we love to have him on the show. Just a reminder, Sunday night show, 2 hours, all about character actors. And then Wednesday, I forgot to mention this earlier, we have a show dedicated to the film Halloween. We're going to examine the original, and we're also going to talk a lot about the remake, the Rob Zombie film. Our guests are being finalized, but the one that is 100% confirmed is Malik Akkad. He is the son of the producer of the original Halloween, and he himself is the producer of this remake. And we're hoping to get Mr. Zombie himself.
And I'll be doing my best Malcolm McDowell impersonations.
That'll be good. Malcolm McDowell in this film or Clockwork Orange?
All Malcolm McDowell films. Everything. Just
in
like
general.
Oh, Lucky Man, Clockwork Orange, Time After Time.
That'll be good. You can go on the road with that.
I probably will be shut down within the first 5 minutes of that first show.
We got great shows in the future that we're planning. There's a film called Canvas, directed by Joseph Greco and starring Marcia Gay Harden and Joe Pantoliano. We're going to do a show on that in September. We're planning an hour-long tribute of sorts to director Stanley Kubrick in honor of the special edition box set of his work that's coming out October 23rd. On and on and on, we're going to talk about fall films, which looks like an astounding season for quality movies.
I know.
So there's a lot to look forward to on the horizon at Movie Geeks United. If you have any suggestions for us about show content or you just want to chat about movies, you can always email us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com or look us up on MySpace, add us as a friend, subscribe to our blog, and communicate with us through there. That's it for tonight's show. Great, entertaining show.
Yeah, awesome.
And we thank you so much, and we'll see you Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Thanks so much, guys.
All right, thanks. Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.